Hey everybody, back with another bald movie. This time we're considering the 1999 American psychological thriller, The Talented Mr. Ripley. This is written and directed by Anthony Minghella, who also directed and got a lot of acclaim for The English Patient, but whose career was tragically cut short by a hemorrhage after throat surgery in his early 50s. It's based on a 1955 Patricia Highsmith novel of the same name, which I did not know this, Jim, but it's actually a series of five books around the Talented Mr. Ripley. It's like a dark version of the Bourne series.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds right.
Which is pretty dark by its own right. It stars Matt Damon as Tom Ripley, Jude Law as Dickie Greenleaf, Gwyneth Paltrow, my water personal acting Waterloo, as Marge Sherwood. Kate Blanchett as Meredith Loge. Is it Loge? Luge?
Logue, I think Logue. Is how she said it.
Yeah, they're of the textile Logues.
Right.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman in full Mega Chad mode as Freddie Miles. You don't get to see that gear from the Hoff Monster very often.
I kind of don't like it. Like, it's not a gear that I really appreciate in Hoffman's gearbox. I like most of his other gears better, although I will say he's not bad. He's not bad.
This film was nominated for five Academy Award films, including Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Supporting Actor for Jude Law. Did not win any of those things, but made a lot of money. And 20 years later is still a really well-regarded psychological thriller. This is about, I think, the third time I've seen it, probably not within the last 10 years, but I quite enjoyed my rewatch of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Jim, what did you think of this movie?
I've never seen it before. It's my first time watching it, and I was surprised by it. I really, really enjoyed it, but it was surprising because I think this is a weird name for this movie. For some reason, I go into this thinking like I'm about to watch the Pianist, Adrian Brody. Mm-hmm. I keep thinking like, I'm just going to see, you know, these high society people doing high society things. And then I get into this murder mystery and I'm like, or this psycho thriller. I don't know what to call this thing. It's very strange, very strange. But man, I loved it.
It is a very strange film, and I think a lot of that comes from just the awkwardness of Tom on a wing and a prayer trying to stay one step ahead of these high society people and stay, you know, embedded within their society. Because there is like, he's not like socially, he's socially awkward, but not hopeless.
Sure.
And a lot of like I found myself cringing a lot because he is trying and mostly succeeding, but a lot of times frequently failing to fit in. And he's hyper aware of all those things and trying to correct like in mid sentence sometimes. Yeah. And it gives like this like really interesting kind of halting alien quality to Matt Damon's performance, which I thought, you know, like I think we should start talking about, I guess what we should do before we start talking about anything is give a synopsis of the film, and then we can get spoilery. Because if you're like Jim, you haven't seen this, I would encourage you to stop if you're interested at all in watching a very young, very talented cast set in gorgeous, gorgeous Mediterranean settings, and have it be like a pretty slick thriller. You want to stop now because, you know, as thrillers go, if you load a plot, then there goes half the suspense. So this is a film about a young piano player named Tom Ripley, who is kind of like making his way, doing small odd jobs, playing a piano party here, working a bathroom attendant there. But he's mistaken for a Princeton grad by a wealthy shipbuilding family and is soon sent to Italy to retrieve their playboy son so that he can assume the role of heir to their family's dynasty. Arriving in Italy, he quickly finds his man, but soon becomes enamored with his lavish, carefree lifestyle and does whatever he can to fit into this society and maintain his position at all costs, even his own identity. This is a really fun and impressive cast, and I kind of wanted to start there. You have Matt Damon, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Kate Blanchett all within a few years of recent Academy Award wins. For very high profile, you know, much discussed, you know, Good Will Hunting, Elizabeth, Shakespeare in Love. You got Jude Law at just the start of his rise to stardom. You got, like I said, Philip Seymour Hoffman playing this kind of like super wealthy Chad character, which I really liked Philip Seymour. It's funny to hear you say that you didn't like him, because this is like the, like, I mean, he's a little bit of a meathead and twister, but he's a stupid one. And this, yeah. He's like a very smart, well-educated, urbane meathead. Mm-hmm. But when he pops, he drives to Rome and he pops out of that like red, you know, roadster and proclaims, "Don't you want to fuck every woman you see just once?" As I don't know, there's something to that. Something to that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not that I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman was bad in this movie. I think he's excellent. But that character, ugh.
Tommy, how's the peeping?
Nah.
How's the peeping, Tommy?
It's okay. The whole vibe I get, and uh-huh. I think this, you know, is obviously intentional. This rich upper class sort of, you know, looking down their noses at the underclass and playing with them as they would play, as a child would play with, you know, a toy train or whatever, watching it, seeing how simple and stupid it is, and mm-hmm. and reveling in how, just reveling in the joy they get from not being part of that class is like really offensive and off-putting to me. And you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, but to a larger degree, Jude Law's character Dickie in this movie does that.
Yeah, I mean, Jude Law goes a long way to making this movie work, because Dickie is not ever painted out to be like a respectable character.
No.
Who has much in the way of compassion or nicety. Just like one scene where Gwyneth Paltrow tries to say like, "Oh, I wish people could see the tender Dickie that I see at the side of the pillow, blah, blah, blah." But yeah, he's very careless with the way he uses people. But he's also megawatt charming. And
that's the thing. I think it's attractive. A testament to the integrity of the Academy that they didn't just hand Jude Law the award. Because goddamn yeah. it, is it fair in life for someone to be this charismatic and good looking and just magnetic?
Yeah, and it's
fucking
like,
wrong. It shouldn't happen.
I read this long think piece on The Ringer where they're talking about there's a particular type of like this basic unfairness when someone like this walks up and the sun only improves their complexion. They come out of salt water and their hair is just like just so right. and wavy and blonde highlight kissed by the sun. Like in him and Gwyneth Paltrow kind of, even though she's got a lot fair complexion, they both have this kind of like, "Oh, I am a platinum blonde with pale skin, but now I look like I'm a sun-kissed orange." And it is. Yeah, it's super. And also, he's instantly believable as anyone's love interest. Man, woman, sure. There between. Like, if Jude Law comes up to you and at a bar and wiggles his eyebrows, you're at least intrigued.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, you take the drink he's offering, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying he's able to seal the deal. No one's that good looking, but sure. Like he's you kind of like you give it a moment's thought. Mm-hmm. And I think he's just really good at being this like lazy, carefree American living in post-war Italy and, you know, kind of like. That's the other kind of like interesting thing about him is that he's like a man with no country, but he like the claims the best parts of everything for himself. Like he takes jazz out of America. He takes kind of like the Mediterranean culture and cuisine and the fashion and he's all somewhat master of it. Like he's got this like little hole in the wall jazz club that he's essentially completely taken over. Mm-hmm. It's a really good and compelling performance. And if he didn't absolutely crush Dickie, thus none of this, the movie would work.
Sure. I agree. How'd you feel about Matt Damon's performance in this?
I think Matt Damon's good, and especially was good back in the day because, you know, he's got this like just very boyish good looks and kind of all American charm in his own way. That's a little bit more heartland, where Jude Law's mm-hmm. is a little bit more international urbane. Yeah. But he's just very awkward in mm-hmm. this film and aware of the awkwardness. And And there's a lot of like little things he does, like he's a little too quick to smile sometimes. Mm-hmm. He's a little too late to smile on others.
He's a little too long in a smile sometimes.
It dwells a little bit, like his gaze lingers too long in inappropriate locations. Also, like it takes him a little bit longer to respond sometimes, because you can kind of see him, especially in the tail end of this film, like rapidly trying to process the angles. Yeah. Like, oh God, who... And sometimes it's like the decision, like, well, who can I kill? Who can I get away with killing? You know, yeah. This woman is a textile heiress. Probably not. Ah, oh, God, the gay lover that I actually love. Ah, you know, there's something really unsettling about that. And the mm-hmm. fact that he's aware of it's being unsettling at all times is also like super unsettling as well. My one critique, I think the talented Miss Ripley is supposed to be like this master of impression, and like has this ability to like use accent and voice work and all that kind of stuff. Matt Damon is not great. Like every single time he does like mm-hmm. what's supposed to be a dead on pitch perfect impression of somebody, I'm thinking, nope, that's yeah. all I can hear is his Matt Damon from Team America. What'd you think of him?
Yeah, I liked him. I agree with your assessment of his impressions. They're not amazing, but I did like his performance. I thought, you know, all the things we mentioned about the creepy smile, the processing of all the angles, all that stuff added up to a performance that I really believed. And really, that's all you're going for as an actor, right? Like he's not supposed to be a super charming character. He's supposed to be that guy who's a little off-putting, but manages to cover it up well enough that he gets by in any situation. And I think Matt Damon apparently like, you know, prepped for this role in surprising ways. I guess he lost like 30 pounds.
Yeah. And Jude Law unbelievably gained about the same amount of weight.
Yeah. It's crazy to me. Cause I guess I didn't see that as necessary. But maybe subconsciously it was adding something to the off-putting nature of his character. I don't know.
Yeah, also I guess in the early scenes he wore full body makeup to make him look like unnaturally pale and pallid too, because you see Matt Damon, he seems like he tans pretty well, just as well as Jude Law, but he's supposed to look like that pasty white that hasn't had a lot of time to lay at the beach, and they did a lot of that stuff, like the physicality. Yeah, Matt was, it seems like, really hot for this role. Mm-hmm. Leonardo DiCaprio was the one that they wanted to get for it, and he passed on it, so Matt Damon said yes.
Sure.
And there you go. I was surprised, because like long-term fans of Bald Move will know that I kind of have a personal antagonist relationship with one Gwyneth Paltrow. She is the acting equivalent of nails on a chalkboard for me. But I actually, there's two roles that I know off the top of my head that I like her in, and one is the first Iron Man movie as Pepper Potts, and the second one is this, because like she blends in this role that I don't even see fucking goop vagina candle Paltrow here. I just see this poor Marge woman who is just as helpless before the charms of Dickie Greenleaf as anyone in a movie.
Yeah.
And she sympathizes with the way Tom is kind of cast aside in the part of the movie. And she's one of the only ones that sees through to Tom's truly rotten core, maybe because she gave him so much. So she took him seriously as a person. Mm-hmm. And she does a lot of like really interesting work as being like very frightened in that one scene where he's trying to menace her with the razor. And then, you know, being this tragic, a vindictive character who's ultimately right, but treated as this like hysterical woman. I really liked Gwyneth Paltrow in this movie. What the fuck?
I was not as impressed with Gwyneth Paltrow in this movie. I was more impressed with Cate Blanchett, actually. It's certainly a more nuanced performance from Cate Blanchett, I think. But they're in those moments that you're talking about where she's, you know, being menaced. I was seeing the performance a little too much. Mm. Not feeling like this was enough of a character, and maybe it's the movie's fault. Maybe it's they don't make her into as much of a character as many of the other characters in this film. But I found myself like really looking more toward Cate Blanchett as like the dominant lead female in this movie.
Wild, because she is she's almost always treated as a complication.
Uh-huh.
You know, like anytime that Tom's doing or Tom as Dickie's doing pretty well, here comes Kate Blanchett to be like,
yeah,
Dickie. And it's instantly everything that's already a complicated situation is now three times more complicated because she's yet another ball to juggle. But I mean, I think it was just the performance.
Yeah, it was just a performance that I liked better.
She's really good at the high society type roles, too, because she was pretty outstanding in like The Aviator in a very similar kind of role. I don't know. She's got that kind of effortless like elegance and charm. And this I talked about how there's a lot of like catch, like this is like a dark version of Catch Me If You Can, which interestingly enough, Leonardo DiCaprio actually headed up that film. Where, I mean, like, what's the difference between Catch Me If You Can and Tom Ripley? The fact that the guy who was it Frank Mangella or whatever, he stopped short of killing people because it seems like they were motivated It seems like they were like motivated by entirely the same forces. It's just Frank had some kind of core of goodness inside him where Tom was just empty and hollow inside.
Core of goodness. Man, there's a whole spectrum there. Goodness is, I don't know that that's a thing I would necessarily label Frank Abagnale with, but
yeah,
badness is certainly a thing I would label Mr. Ripley with. So maybe like, yeah, Abagnale is not nearly as bad of a person as Ripley.
Yeah.
And so, yeah,
he walks that scoundrel line. He walks that very thin scoundrel line, whereas Tom just I don't know how you break down this act. So I guess I feel like that when Philip Seymour Hoffman's Freddy shows up, that's the end of Act One, which is essentially the rise of Tom. And then his murder of Dickie ends kind of like the second act.
Which was kind of surprising to me because I was watching this movie and I saw the boat scene and I'm like, okay, he's dead. He's going to, you know, subsume his life into his own. And some, you know, the movie will end here and we'll be left to either wonder, you know, does he get caught or does he succeed in whatever whatever integration he's trying to do here. And then there's another hour of the movie. Like, I guess I wasn't expecting, I thought that was the third act.
Yeah, it's a heist film, and what he's doing is stealing another man's life, or at least attempting to.
And it just keeps unfolding. Like, that's the thing about this movie. Every time I think, okay, either the jig is up and he's caught, or the movie is coming to its conclusion, there's another chapter unfolding. And this movie is really brilliant in that it keeps you just one step behind it the entire time, and you're always so caught up in the moment and how he's going to get out of this situation that you don't see the things he's doing to set up the next deception. And I think that's maybe the biggest strength of this entire film as a thriller.
Sometimes he doesn't even see, right? Like,
he's an opportunist
to
improvise.
For sure. Yeah. And like sometimes like he's always reaching for a higher branch and sometimes he doesn't have his arm quite or, you know, something, because he's always trying to maximize his success, but also minimize his danger. And sometimes those like goals come into conflict.
Yeah.
You know, where like at the end of the film, I don't know if we're ready to talk about this or not, but like he was ready to get away with literal murder. And the last 45 minutes where he's like dodging the cops, he's dodging private investigators, he's dodging Dickie's friends and acquaintances and trying to have this elaborate like fantasy of him and Dickie still being best friends and, you know, oh, you just missed him. I mean, it's like some ridiculous Adam West Batman shit.
Uh-huh.
Like on some of these scenes, like that engineered meeting between Meredith and Marge at the cafe where he's watching over it and like split second timing. It literally did feel like, you know, Adam West sending his old ass butler as Batman and convincing Commissioner Gordon that, oh no, we can't possibly be the same person.
Right.
It's ridiculous, but it's also deadly serious because whenever he runs, like he always tries to isolate his person. There's only like one or two people that stand in his way of success and he murders them. But the end, he's gotten away with it. He's gotten Dickie framed for his own murder and the murder of the other guy he committed. He's inherited this guy's inheritance and fortune. and now he can live free and clear as Tom Ripley for the rest of his life. And you're thinking, I don't know. I'm like, well, am I happy for this guy? What's going on? He's got this sweet boyfriend. And then fucking Cate Blanchett shows up with a dickie. And the whole, and there, he's on a boat in the middle of the ocean going to America. And there's only, you can see him try to different possibilities. Like go back to his lover and be like, let's just stay in our stateroom and fuck all voyage long. And that's not going to work. And then he try, and then he finds out this guy saw him kiss Meredith and.
Yep.
It's
and it spirals fucking out of control again.
That last scene where he's has his boyfriend talk about like what a good person he is as he eventually starts choking him to death is as chilling a thing I've ever seen.
That is an astounding ending to this film. I was thoroughly impressed. I just sat there going, holy shit. It's a tribute to the editor of this film, just how I felt at the end of this movie.
I also think that, you know, this Anthony Minghella guy is no slouch, too, because setting up that shot where, like, you know, Matt Damon is sitting devastated on the edge of a bed and he's on a ship and there's all these mirrors on doors and like cabinets that are like swaying back and forth, revealing different sides and images and facets of him. Like, that is a hell of a shot to composite and put together. And it also reminded me of an early one. There's one in the midpoint where him and Dickie are in a bathroom, I think, and the mirror is reflecting like Jude Law's full face, but we see like Matt Damon in a profile and they're merged right at that central nose line.
Yeah, when they're in the train.
Oh, that's what it was, in a train. And I'm just like, man, what a shot, because you can see like the wheel spinning in Tom's head about like, I could actually take this guy's identity. And yet this composite image is this weird kind of Picasso, you know, cubist painting of a thing. I was like, man, outside of just this outstanding natural beauty that they're able to capture from going up and down the coastline of Italy, some of those shots I thought were really nice grace points for this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see why you love Italy, by the way.
It's amazing, man. It's amazing. It's funny to see all the places that I went on my trips in this movie.
Because you spent a lot of time in Venice over the last 2 years.
In Italy, yeah. I've been to Rome and Venice, which are featured pretty prominently in this movie, like St. Mark's, you know, Piazza San Marco is like pretty prominently featured.
Yeah.
In the film. And yeah, it's always funny to see, like, you know, even smaller ones like Piazza Navona or any of those ones in Rome are like kind of neat to see.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an entirely different place than where I'm from, obviously.
Yeah,
But it just seems like it's got like the best parts of like desert, mountain, coast. It's just a beautiful country.
And they shot on location in a lot of these places. So yeah, all those places you're seeing are really those locations, which some of those shots, how they get them, I'm kind of amazed that they could. Like, they must have had some sort of government sponsorship here where the government was helping them shut down and keep crowds out and stuff like that, because those places are remarkably crowded all the time.
Well, the other thing is they made it seem like it's this endless Italian summer. And I guess that was actually problematic because the weather, they actually had this very stormy, there's in this very stormy season on the coast, and it's supposed to be like the sun drenched landscape, and they got like, I guess, like minutes at a time. Like, they would go and film like one side of a dialogue and then the rain would start and they'd have to come back in, wait for it to, like, it seemed like it was a real nightmare to film because the weather just refused to cooperate. But you'd never tell, like, because the thing does look exactly how they want it to. Everything is just beautifully lit by golden hour lighting all the time. And you know, watching them zip up and down these cobblestone streets on their little scooters is just a lot of fun.
And then, yeah, I love the fashion and the transportation and the scenery. But like, I keep forgetting when I'm looking at these scenes, because I was there, you know, the last year, that this takes place in the 50s. Like, you got to remember, this is like a 1950s era film, a period film. And nothing, like, that's the thing about these old cities. Nothing has changed there. You know, it's like, okay, we've got maybe a few more pieces of signage up, and maybe like the overhang, like the fabric overhangs or umbrellas that they're using at the cafe tables are a little different, but for the most part, it looks exactly the same.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, why wouldn't it? It's looked like Rome, right, when you want to go back, has looked exactly the same for 2,000 years.
Exactly. It's not going to change in 50.
Which is funny because, like, you think of that, like, Milan and everything being, like, one of the centers of fashion. But yet there's this timeless quality to the places they live. Maybe that's why they go crazy on the fashion side.
There you go.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. So we've talked a little bit about Matt Damon's character, Tom Ripley. I had a lot of trouble pinning that character down in this movie, and I think that's intentional. I think you're supposed to be wondering, because he himself is wondering about his own identity, right? And one of the things, one of the themes that keeps coming up is that he's gay. And I couldn't tell if this was a put on from Tom Ripley or if this, like, something he did just to ingratiate himself to people that he thought might be interested in that sort of person, or if he genuinely had those feelings, especially as it goes down to, like, Peter, because I think when you look at Dickie and his relationship, that was definitely a little, like, is romantic the right word? I don't know. Sexual?
Certainly romantic. I mean, just the reaction he had after he killed Dickie, where he's like cradling him in the bottom of the boat. There was some genuine feeling there. But also, it's hard to tell because, like, when it was Cecily and I were watching, I'm like, what do you think that Matt, do you think Matt Damon's character here is gay, or is he like asexual, or is this part of like his predatory disguise? Is he like a,
right,
an opera sexual or a sexual tunist, like whatever he needs to be to get to that next branch? Because, like, what do we know about Tom? What are Tom's hobbies and passions? Music, I guess, but he doesn't like jazz. He pretends to like jazz.
But he's like memorizing the songs in a way that's like systematic. He's not enjoying that. He's doing it because he thinks it'll get him ahead. And so, I don't know what we know about that guy. Nothing.
Yeah. Like the only thing he likes is success and a lavish lifestyle and art and wearing fancy clothes. Like these are like what he's really passionate about, I guess, is consumption, you know, conspicuous consumption.
And
but
maybe status.
But yeah, and that's one of the things, like, I had a question for you is, like, is this one of those problematic evil gaze type films? Because on the one hand, it's made in 99, which is like at the cusp of where Hollywood stopped. Hollywood always does a bunch of stupid shit. But, like, you know, they started being a little bit more, hey, maybe there's other ways we can code villainous people other than having them be gay or have a physical disability or, you know, some kind of birth defect. Like, maybe there's other ways to code people as evil rather than that. But I felt like when I read a lot of commentary and a lot of it seems like this thing came out and it hit Netflix like late last year and a lot of people were watching it. I wasn't aware of it, but there was a lot of big pieces on like Vanity Fair and Ringer and some of these other places where they did like a 20 years after the 20 year anniversary of, you know, Talented Mr. Ripley. What do we think about it? And a couple of them touched on that question, but ultimately like gave it a pass. And I think that that's the key because it doesn't feel like Tom Ripley is gay as much as it feels like he's just predatory.
Yeah. It feels like this is a mentally deranged person doing whatever he needs to do to accomplish his goals.
Yeah. And like that's is James Bond gay? Because like canonically, he will make passes at male agents if it gets him an advantage. No, he's an opportunist, takes advantage to serve his other goals and motives. So I don't know. I honestly will say that the first time I saw that as a devout Christian, a lot of the gay subtext completely missed me. I didn't get the idea that that there was as much of a romantic triangle between like Freddie and Dickie and Tom as there was like a competition for attention and money angle. Uh-huh. I thought that Dickie more or less rebuffed Tom, which I guess he did. Like, I thought that was something that like Tom did as part of his camouflage and just misread the situation. But now I watch it, you know, with like fresh modern eyes with the scales pulled off and like, holy moly, there's a lot of, gay sexual tension, you know, bubbling through this film.
And, you know, when you mix it up with the identity stuff, because the at the core of it, you know, Tom Ripley doesn't know who he is because he's lost the thread. You know, he's not mentally stable. I think to begin with, and then once he gets into these deceptions so deep, he starts confusing himself on who he is. And so, you know, when I'm watching the movie, I'm thinking, okay, does he even understand what something other than what he just wants out of this situation? Does he understand who he is in any given moment? And there are times when he slips up and he calls himself Dickie when he shouldn't be in that role. He should be in the Tom role. And so like the movie confuses it, and I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes it great, because it kept me uneasy the entire time, not knowing who Tom Ripley is. And at the same time, I think there's a lot of stuff that Tom Ripley is saying and that other characters are, you know, saying to him. Like there several times in the movie there are moments where if there is a real Tom Ripley, it starts to kind of bubble to the surface, where he talks about, you know, the fucking terrifying dialogue where he's talking about, we all have things that we lock away in a basement and refuse to ever go in that room. And I'm like, that's fucking dark. That's real dark. But like, in some ways I identify with this as somebody who grew up in a cult, never believed in the cult, but had to pretend for their entire childhood that this was something they were into, at least enough to get by, enough to not get hassled. It's like, that could probably drive you insane if you did it long enough.
I think you're exactly right. And there's a lot of like, this movie begins with some crib dialogue at the end of the movie where like Tom's lamenting. It's like, you know, I wish I could just start erasing everything and like erase myself. And that's like also when he writes the suicide note for Dickie and he blots out his own face in the passport. Well, I guess Dickie's face in the passport. But like, you get the idea when he's reading the suicide note that it's essentially Tom talking about himself.
Yeah.
And then when Dickie's dad shows him the passport where he's like completely erased himself and said, like, who does this? And you realize it's Tom. Like, Tom has erased himself to the point of like, what is there of his original personality left? He's so compartmentalized, so locked down. I wonder if you asked Tom how many people he murdered in this film, if he would even be able to give an accurate count. Because I bet he's got a rationalization and like the ability to analyze a sequence of like, you know, like, was I Tom or Dickie when I killed Freddy?
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, that Frank Abagnale type of thing.
Did Tom or Dickie murder Peter? Like, Dickie murdered Peter, not Tom. Tom was in love with Peter. It's so weird crazy, and fucked up to where he can like look and it's always fun when like there's like 3 points in a film. I think Dickie does it once. Marge does it to him once, and then Dickie's dad does it to him once, where they essentially recount something that Tom did and says, you know, what kind of person would do that, or like what would drive a person to do that, and like. They always pan to Tom's face and he's just got this kind of like plastic smile. Yeah. It's really, really fucking creepy.
It is.
And I don't usually think of creepy when I think of Matt Damon. So sure. Pretty good. I mentioned in the pre-podcast, I thought that there was a little bit of like Parasite. And there's a little commentary like the fact that these wealthy people are very good at sniffing out people that don't belong. They're superficially easy to fool, but then like you require a lot of depth into your deception. Like you can be betrayed by how you look, how you smell, what accent you have, if you have calluses on your hands, what type of music you enjoy, like the fact that you pick up after yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought that was great how Dickie, it just really bothered him that, like, Tom picks up after himself and others, where clearly a guy who's never had to, you know, like, when he fucks up an apartment, he either hires a cleaning lady or just sails up the coast and gets another one.
Yeah.
It's stuff like that I thought was really interesting. Like, Freddie coming over and, like, dismissing all the hard work Tom has done in this apartment as bougie. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, like, did Tom kill Freddy because he was a danger, a clear and present danger to him, or because he insulted his bourgeoisie middle class taste?
A little of both, maybe.
I think so. Oh. And also, there's also the idea that like, you know, Dickie and Marge are not contributing anything to society. They're just taking things. They themselves are parasites on their wealthy, you know, shipping magnate mothers and fathers and textile, you know, all these robber barons and big important people. And you're kind of like, I guess, in the beginning, rooting for Tom to get away with this. But then as the bodies start stacking up and I'm like, I stayed sympathetic to the family, to the underclass family in Parasite up to the very end of the movie. Yeah. But clearly halfway through, I, you know, start feeling like, OK, Tom, you've gone too fucking far. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's just because Parasite stops essentially where this first act of the movie begins. You know, they've had a body count or two, but like there's a lot more that they kind of stop it there. They don't can chronicle the family's ever increasing descent into depravity to keep up the subterfuge, where like the entire half of Talented Mr. Ripley is just that.
Yeah. No, yeah, you're right. And, you know, that kind of speaks to how I thought the movie was basically over, and then it has another hour. And even at the end of the movie, it's not over. You know, he's killed Peter, but what's he going to do with the body? Is he going to get away with it? Can he?
Plus, he's now Dickie again, and Dickie's dead. How is he going to? Like, I almost want to read the books to see, like, what happens when he returns to America with Meredith.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to be Dickie Greenleaf, but that guy's dead in Italy.
Yeah, I mean, Meredith is a loose end. I assume she's got to go overboard at some point.
But why not just do that instead of killing your boyfriend? I don't know, because you know, the end of the movie is really bleak. Because what is his? He's almost rooting for it to sink like the fucking Titanic. Like that would be like the best thing that could happen. Because then, you know, who knows what could happen in all that chaos? But there's this madcap energy that, like, even though like Tom Ripley's unambiguously evil and a villain, like I found myself. I don't know if rooting for it is the right way, but just kind of like breathlessly, you know, like how, like, I guess kind of like late stage Walter White, like you're a bastard, but damn, I'm kind of invested in seeing how you get out of this one.
Oh yeah.
The mad risks he takes, like there's a couple points where like, I was like biting my fingernails, just him smelling Jude Law on a train.
He thinks
Jude Law is going to be stuck in Rome because he missed the last train, forgetting the fact that these are rich people with cars, and he's doing this putting on the Ritz routine in Dickie's underwear, and that, oh God, the full body cringe of when Jude Law walks in and just judges the shit out of all of this. And how the complications just keep in adding up and up. Like, that fucking opera scene was amazing. The roller coaster of emotions when he finds out he's going to be meeting Dickie's father, and then the slow realization that, like, oh shit, I'm under zero suspicion. Like, I thought I was really fighting for my life, but now, like, in this American investigator comes over and he starts the conversation with, like, in America, we're taught to not trust a fact until it's established as a fact. I'm like, well, brother, you need to come talk to us in 2020. But you think that, like, oh, this is it for him. But it turns out, nah, because they've got their preconceptions and what they want to believe and what they want to happen to keep things quiet for the family. It's just a fucking really tightly well-engineered plot that had me, you know, on edge for the last entire hour of the film.
It's an exceptionally crafted story, I think.
And then, like I said, the ending is just gutting. Like, it just left me completely empty feeling. And just like, God.
And to I had several of those moments. Like, that boat scene was gutting. Like, the boat scene is fucking intense. And and I knew what was coming, and it didn't seem to stifle that intensity at all.
Yeah, because you got this, because, you know, Dickie's a bit of a dick, and you get this idea that he can't just break up with people. He's the type that, like, has to use and abuse till someone else, like, has enough and then taps out. And, like, you can see him, like, he's like, hey, let's take this boat ride, and let's find a new apartment. But then he starts fucking and making, like, Tom feel very uncomfortable and unsafe. And then when he gets out and he's all alone, he just starts unloading onto Tom, and all this pent up frustration and creepiness just comes out. And then, yeah, like, Jesus, the beating him to death of the oar, it's wild, wild stuff.
Yeah,
Philip Seymour Hoffman getting beat to death by some kind of Roman bust.
Okay. Let's talk about that bust, because I am under the distinct impression that that is Jude Law with a beard.
No,
am I wrong?
I mean, I don't know. I just assumed it was like Homer or some shit like that. Like, you know, like what what some kind of lower middle class person would think a, you know, it's like Donald Trump. Essentially, it's Donald Trump design, like a poor man's idea of how a rich person would decorate their Italian flat.
It's gaudy. It's obscene.
Neoclassical, but no, but from all different periods and tastes and design.
Vulgar.
Vulgar.
Okay, maybe it's not Jude Law, but I like what they were doing with the statue stuff, because at the beginning of the movie, they show a headless statue. He sort of walks away from a headless statue, and I don't remember if he's lined up with it when where he turns and the camera moves. They kind of put his head on that, but, like, you know, as much as this movie has, or that character has a thing, his thing is this switching of identities and swapping the heads on a statue without one might be seen as thematically appropriate.
Do you have any conspiracy theories about Dickie's or Tom's involvement with the death of that young Italian woman?
I assumed it was Tom.
I did too, but I don't think there's anything in the movie to suggest that, other than, like, when he says, I would do anything, like, post, like, it's almost like he's eager to take the credit for it. Like, I'd do anything for you, Tom. You're like a brother. I'll take the blame.
But I, like, feel like this is the warm up. This is like, this is them saying something is really wrong in this relationship. And we don't know yet that Tom is a killer. We haven't seen him kill anybody, but I think it's one of those things in retrospect, you look at it and say, oh, that was probably Tom.
But also the other way, because I kind of wanted to watch this again to see if there is any, because, like, the timeline is such that I don't know how he would have done it. But there's also the idea that, like, maybe Dickie did it, because they introduced the idea that he almost beat someone to death in a fit of pique in Princeton. And he's had these other violent outbursts over his life. And, you know, when he found out that she died, like, he fucking goes a little sunny Corleone and starts trashing the place because he's so fucking pissed off and, like, you know, can't control his emotions. And there's this idea that, like, maybe Dickie did it, and then, because that seems like that's how really that's the core of what soured their relationship, is that Dickie had this, like, you know, traumatic thing happened with this Italian woman, and it kind of blew up. And Tom said that, like, hey, if you're going to get in trouble, like, why did Tom say that? Like, I feel like another interpretation is Tom thought that Dickie did it because it's inconsistent with how he would do it or like his understanding of Dickie, and he was offering to take the rap and be his brother and lover and all this stuff, and that when Dickie spurned him shortly after, that's what gave him the idea to do the murder.
I don't know if that tracks through. You could be right. I think like there's a bit of like a Tom-esque plot in that section for Dickie, because he's caught up in, you know, these multiple relationships with multiple women. And if you believe him about her being pregnant, that's certainly a complication in what is already a pretty complicated emotional patchwork here. Mm-hmm. And you know, along with the history of violence, you could start to wonder about him.
Yeah. I don't know. It seems like it would reward multiple watches. There's also, I guess, there's a previous version of this that was filmed earlier, because this, you know, book series is kind of successful. And I kind of want to go back and see that, because I guess a lot of people say that that's the canonical Tom Ripley. Hmm. Like the actor that they get to play him is just like utterly convincing. And some of the ways that I thought Matt Damon did a great job, and he brought his own kind of unique spin to the thing. But like, I do think there was some seams to the performance. Like the literal seams that they had in the intro where they were like showing him in split relief lighting and like kind of getting the idea early in the film that this is a fractured kind of jigsaw piece of a person. He's like a beam of light that's been split into its composite colors or something. A film I like Gwyneth Paltrow in. What a rare and beautiful achievement. All right, that'll do it for The Talented Mr. Ripley. We'll be back next week. Jim and I are going to see Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men, something I actually have never gotten around to seeing in the last 15 years. And you say you have seen?
Yeah, I've seen it once.
It's a dystopian kind of sci-fi thriller. I have no idea what the plot is about at all. So I'm going in completely blind and looking forward to that. If you want to watch it with us, it's available to rent or buy in a lot of locations, but it's also streaming for free if you have a Starz subscription or a DirecTV subscription, or any of the add-on, like, you know, Starz on Hulu, Starz on Amazon. You can watch it for free. But yeah, if you're excited about that, check us out next week. We'll be talking about Children of Men. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.